Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts on it. I'm Claire Wiley. And in today's show, we are going to be speaking with Anna Robertson, who is the co-founder of The Cool Down, who is coming on the show to discuss the LA fires and how they are changing conversations about the future, including innovations in resilient home building and landscaping. She'll also talk about new technology for more eco-friendly flights, and then co-founder, that is, of Food Tank. Danielle Nuremberg is going to come on the show. Food Tank will be hosting its fourth annual all-day food and environment summit during Sundance this Saturday. That's all coming up on This Green Earth. Stay with us. And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley. And we are having in the studio with me now co-founder of The Cool Down, Anna Robertson. Anna, welcome back to This Green Earth.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for having me back.
You have been part of our show before, but for listeners who aren't familiar with you and your background, please give us an intro into yourself and what led you to founding The Cool Down.
Yeah. For anybody not familiar with The Cool Down, we are really a guide to making choices that help you to save money and live healthier and help the planet as well. And so we reach about 30 to 35 million people a month. We are the largest climate and sustainability brand, but we approach, you know, climate through the things people love, right? Whether that's gardening, home renovation, thrifting, and really thinking about, you know, what matters to you in your life, which, you know, are those value propositions around saving money, living healthier. And obviously we all want to do things that are better for ourselves and better for the planet. And so my background is a journalist. I have been a journalist for several decades. I, you know, grew up at ABC News, Good Morning America. I was Diane Sawyer's producer for many years. Worked at Yahoo, Disney, et cetera. And so I've always been a storyteller, and I started The Cool Down really because I felt like we needed to, you know, connect more people to climate topics in ways that were more practical and accessible, focused on innovation and less about making these issues political. Together with my co-founders, Dave Finocchio, Ryan Alberti, who came from Bleacher Report, which is, you know, obviously one of the behemoth sports connective sites, we decided to start The Cool Down to see if we could connect mainstream America to climate topics in ways that really weren't dominated by doom and gloom, but by the solutions that we know exist to help create a better future.
And there is quite a breadth of information that you provide on there. You break it all down. And also it's in terms that people can understand, so it feels digestible.
That's right. Yeah, that's our approach. I mean, too much climate content is just too complicated, overwhelming for people, again, dominated by doom and gloom. And there is so much innovation that's happening in this space. So we want people to connect with the opportunity that we have to create a better future as opposed to the fear that we can't, and give people practical ways that they can make changes in their own lives, as well as demand change from companies and from our government, et cetera. So, we really approach things in a very different way than any climate and sustainability brand. And we have a whole guide to help people get started, and great newsletters. So we put out about 5 newsletters a week that people can subscribe to with really easy tips and accessible information to really, you know, make it more fun to be part of this.
And I think that's really important for people to feel like that they have action items and things that they, because we all look around and say, how can we be a part of this? And it feels sometimes overwhelming, the vastness of what's happening in the world. But sometimes it's just those little things that you can do or things that you can adapt in your own life that do make a big difference. And having that across a widespread of people and providing that for them is really valuable. I do want to get into some of the things that are happening right now that are kind of hard-pressing topics that we've been facing as of late, including the LA fires. And as I understand it, you have a personal account actually of an evacuation that you had yourself.
Yeah, I mean, you know, evacuating from the wildfires in 2018, I lived in Los Angeles at that time. I was working in the media industry before I started The Cool Down and had evacuated in the middle of the night with my kids. And that was, you know, one of the light bulb moments that for me, that led me to want to devote my entire career to climate change, because I just knew that, you know, it was only going to get worse. I mean, obviously we are seeing, you know, drought, and we're seeing less precipitation. We're seeing a warming planet. And so, you know, the light bulb went off for me, and I looked around and thought, why are people not connecting to this issue as much as I think we need to be? And, you know, obviously the situation in Los Angeles is just devastating. And I have so many friends, dozens of friends who have lost their homes and everything inside of them. And it's just, it's heartbreaking to see what's happening there. And, you know, it's a complicated story because there are a number of factors that go into, you know, creating an event like that. And it's not just one thing, and it's not caused by climate change, but climate change has created this, the circumstances to make these kinds of, you know, extreme weather events more extreme, and has sort of stacked the deck against us in terms of what we can expect. And we've seen that now repeat itself in multiple areas of our country. I mean, look at what happened in Asheville and in the area around Asheville, North Carolina. You know, so we see that happening, and we need to be prepared that this is the new reality we're living in. And so I think it raises a lot of concerns, even for an area like Park City, where we are vulnerable in the summer months, obviously, to wildfires and to extreme weather. And, you know, really kind of making this connection to what's happening is going to be a really important part. And I wonder if other people will have that light bulb moment. I do think we're going to see, you know, just a very changed experience in the Los Angeles area for sure.
And so what do you see as the responses of these fires and how they're affecting these conversations for the future, but also looking at the why? Like, why is this happening? And then how do we move forward?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things there. I think there's very tactical things that we need to be prepared for in terms of just thinking about our own resilience and preparation for wildfires and having that conversation in our own community here and in communities across the country, and thinking about how we're building our homes, how we're creating resilience in our environment, how we're creating landscape and taking care of our landscape. I mean, a lot of, you know, what we did in LA, there were requirements around brush clearing, but as you could see, you know, there were a lot of areas where there was a dangerous kind of situation and a situation that couldn't have been, you know, remedied. So, you know, picking drought tolerant grasses and, you know, landscaping our homes, thinking about, you know, our own home construction when we're building new homes. And then also thinking about, you know, being prepared for a wildfire, having a bag packed that is ready to go, you know, thinking about videotaping your entire home so that you have a record of what your home looks like, you know, taking your plans with you, knowing where the plans to your home are if you do have to face a situation like those in Los Angeles have faced. But I think more broadly, you know, I hope that this spurs a conversation, you know, nationally, globally, around, you know, what is happening to our planet? Because part of the reason we created the cool down is to educate and inform, you know, average people about what is happening and demand better. I think, you know, anytime we've had to do something hard in human history, we've needed the public to be engaged in that. And, you know, extreme weather events, unfortunately, you know, spur that conversation. I don't think we've seen as much coverage of that in the media, which is unfortunate, but also understandable given that we're right in the thick of, you know, the story. And it is a complex story that, you know, involves a lot of different responsibilities among different people. But I think making sure that, you know, as citizens, that we are talking about the causes of some of this and how we can create a better future. And that is by, you know, reducing our dependence on fossil fuels. I mean, it just is. That is a key piece of it that is going to help our planet to, you know, to reduce the warming that we're seeing right now. So I think that's really important to be having that conversation. One of the most important things you can do is just talk about it, you know, with your community, with your family and friends, and bringing it up with those who represent you as well in the government.
Yeah, and talking about that, what's recently happening and our path forward. So you had said it's kind of citizens that now need to stand up and demand better.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you're seeing a lot of, what we're seeing is a lot of consumers are getting much more educated about, you know, the products and services that are available to them, about the choices that they make, even when they go to the grocery store. And so, you know, whether that's signing a petition to ban food dyes, or, you know, using a food scanning app in the grocery store, or reaching out to, you know, to somebody that represents you in Congress to talk about these issues, I do think, you know, that is going to be a huge piece of going forward, you know, how we make change. But also, you know, there's a lot, I know there's a lot of concern about what is happening at the federal level, you know, given withdrawal from Paris Accords and a lot of things that are, you know, not where we want them to be. We don't want to see companies taking a step back from their commitments to climate and sustainability issues. And yet, there is amazing progress that is happening at the local level and through communities, and we have to keep doing that work. This is not a time to step back from those issues and from those, you know, from those priorities, and all just, you know, really come together to figure out how we can, you know, do better.
Absolutely. Now, you were recently at the Consumer Electronics Show, and I'd like for you to share some of those themes as they relate to maybe sustainability and green energy that you saw there, and maybe some promising.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I walked the floors of the Consumer Electronics Show with an eye to sort of consumer climate technologies. What are we going to be seeing in our homes? How are things changing? And so, you know, there are a number of themes that I saw. Obviously, clean energy is going to be a huge, you know, area of growth. We're seeing, you know, enormous interest in heat pumps and solar, et cetera. A lot of what I saw was making solar, you know, more accessible. So if you can't afford solar panels on your home, getting a generator for your home or getting a portable solar generator, batteries that can power, you know, let's say you want a battery to power your refrigerator in case your power goes out. So, you know, really interesting companies that are kind of trying to innovate around, you know, more accessible solutions, as well as helping you keep track of your energy in your home so that you can power that EV as well as a heat pump or as well as, you know, additional electrification devices in our homes. And, you know, so much of our electricity and our household decisions, you know, come from these kinds of things. So ways to save money, ways to breathe better in your home. You know, lots of different focus on air circulation and air purifiers, obviously very relevant to the wildfires that we're discussing, but also, you know, creating a healthier environment in your home. Very, very, you know, big technologies from Panasonic and also startups around that air purifying technology, and a huge focus on EVs. I mean, regardless of what we hear, you know, EVs are really the future, and it's going to get so much easier to operate EVs. That was a big theme, is how do we make electric vehicles easier for people to adopt? So whether that's, you know, eVTOLs, which are electric air taxis, essentially. I spoke to the COO of Archer Aviation, as well as the CSO of Delta Airlines, who really talked about how, you know, he said we're really in science fact, not fiction anymore, with electric air taxis. They're already testing them in several locations, and they're going to be, you know, running them in the United Arab Emirates. And those are going to be, you know, easier ways, obviously, for the luxury client at first to get from, you know, point A to point B in a city, from the airport from your hotel to the airport or the airport to your hotel. And Delta showed a very futuristic kind of video of somebody calling up the air taxi. You know, also got to tour the new Scout vehicles, which is a company that is owned by Volkswagen, but harkens back to the old Scout brand, if you remember that brand. Was very popular between 1960s and 80s, and is just a very nostalgic, you know, truck brand, but also has a 500, you know, mile range extender in their truck. So you're going to see, you know, the introduction of solid state batteries and other technologies that are going to enable you to have a lot more reach in your battery and get rid of that range anxiety. Electric RVs and a lot of really cool electric vehicles. So those are some of the things I saw. I also got a chance to attend Delta Airlines, you know, huge keynote presentation. They took over the Sphere, which is, of course, the hot new venue in Las Vegas, and they did a very splashy presentation with, you know, lots of celebrities there, and Lenny Kravitz performing. And, you know, a key part of what they talked about was that for the future 100 years of Delta is the oldest airline operating in this country and has been in existence for 100 years, you know, sustainability is at the root of what they are doing. Okay. And so we talked a lot about that with their CSO, and, you know, some of the things they're doing to improve efficiency of the planes in flight, because obviously the big thing with flight is the jet fuel and the, you know, the emissions from just flying. So in addition to, you know, shifting to sustainable aviation fuels, helping planes to fly more efficiently by adopting some of the things we've learned from birds and some of the things from nature. So that was pretty exciting, as well as just, you know, some some fun things like creating luggage from the old Delta planes. And, you know, obviously some of the things you see on your flight, which is swapping out plastic, you know, cups for recyclable cups and reducing the footprint of everything they do. And it was really, you know, interesting to see that be a key part of what they talked about, especially when we hear other companies kind of stepping back from talking about sustainability as much.
Yeah, I think you need leaders like that to step up and say that we are thinking about the future and we are thinking about more sustainable ways. I mean, I love to travel. We just talked about that. I love to travel, so it's hard to say that there's anything bad about flying or flight, but it is something that it's taking a lot of energy. And
there's a lot
of things that it's absorbing. And I think that there is a responsibility, if you know that your industry is doing these things, that you do better.
That's right. Yeah. And I mean, that's why a huge focus is on that sustainable aviation fuel and making it, you know, more, you know, making you feel like less guilty. And in California, if you're flying out of California, your plane is already using some sustainable aviation fuel. But right now, really hard to get the scale and the cost down on sustainable aviation fuel. So it's a huge area of focus for every single airline. And it was great to see them, you know, really talking about that. And just to be clear, like, it's not a box to check. It's not something they're doing just because they think they should. The reason they're doing it, as you know, as Amelia DeLuca told me, is because it's a business decision. Mm-hmm. You know, it can save them money. And, you know, by flying more efficiently in this, you know, geese shape formation or adopting any of these things, they're using less fuel. So they have to produce less of that sustainable aviation fuel, which is, you know, more expensive right now. And so, you know, all of these things are really business decisions. And, you know, in addition, they're seeing real research from customers, especially next generation younger customers, that are demanding better, you know, and demanding that things be more sustainable. So they know that to keep that next generation customer loyal to Delta, they need to adopt some of these practices. So I think that's really a key thing here. And it harkens back to how we can feel hopeful about our future, which is that a lot of these decisions are just better. They're better for our health. They're better for our money. They're going to be better for America. You know, we need to be competitive in the renewable energy space, for example, in the clean energy space. We know that, you know, that is the future. And so, you know, I think that when we get concerned about where we're heading, we need to look at, you know, the progress we've made in the last several years towards these areas. It's not going away. The clean energy transition is happening in all aspects of our world, and we need to just lean into that even more.
And I like the positivity of that. And I also want to talk about what you just mentioned about this generation that's coming up. I'm curious, for the cool down, are you seeing in your demographics a lot of younger people who are logging in? What do you kind of see with the people that are really engaging?
Yeah, we do. I mean, we reach 1 in 8 Americans. So we reach, you know, a very broad group of people and not just young people. I think, you know, young people are already on the train, but we see every single age interested and engaged in these topics, because we're not approaching them through, you know, you should care about this because of our climate or because of our planet. It's very hard for people to wrap their heads around mm-hmm. that concept. But we're talking about these things in light of, you know, what do you care about? You know, you should care about these things because you want to renovate your home and you want the best technology, or you want something that's healthier for your family, or you want to find a really unique thrifted piece, or you want to, whatever it might be for you. And that's really how we approach it, without a sense of guilt or, you know, or feeling bad about your choices, but really helping to empower people to make better choices. And I think that's, you know, it's important for everybody at any age. And so we all have a part to play. Obviously, you know, young people, I think, have lived with this and seen this in their own lives and have dealt with, you know, the impacts of extreme weather and a warming planet. So they are keenly sensitive to these topics.
Yeah, and bringing it back to acting locally and those first steps, and what's happening around the world, again, can be very daunting. But if you look at what's happening in your own backyard, you can make actions there.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many simple things that we can do in our own homes. You know, looking to electrify things in our home obviously is a big one. But, you know, we've talked a lot about reducing food waste, which is, you know, something people don't think about as much as they should, because it's such an easy way to not only save money, because how much food do we throw out every week, but also, you know, just reducing, you know, your impact, joining the composting, the food diversion opportunity that Park City Community Foundation has put on here. You you know, participating in those kinds of things, or, you know, asking a local business, you know, when you see that there's something, you know, asking if they have a different alternative. And then there are obviously like bigger things that you can do. Citizens Climate Lobby is an incredible organization that, you know, operates nationwide, but has a great group here in Park City that you can join, you know, supporting the work of climate friendly organizations like Recycle Utah, like the Park City Community Foundation's Climate Fund. I mean, there's so much good work that's happening in our own community here. And literally everything you do personally matters, as well as those bigger actions, you know, getting involved with, you know, organizations like Citizens Climate Lobby, which make it very, very easy for you to reach out to your representatives and let them know that this is a priority for you.
And in looking around, we've got Sundance, and there's a lot of setup with Sundance. I wonder sometimes when someone that's in your vocation and you're doing this, if you drive around and think, you could have done this or you could have done that. Are you seeing things changing even with the festival or...
I mean, I don't have a window into like how much Sundance is doing on the topic. And I think I would drive myself crazy if I did that. Obviously, like, you know, my friends know it makes me crazy. I literally will go dumpster diving at the school, for example, and like move things into recycle bins and stuff. So I can make myself a little crazy on that. But, you know, I'm always excited at Sundance that there are conversations like Danielle, you know, Nirenberg, who's coming here every year. I attend Food Tank, and, you know, that's such a great opportunity. And it's been a real amazing, inspirational moment for me to connect with those kinds of topics, you know, what's happening in the food space around sustainability. And so Sundance always has that theme of sustainability and climate in the storytelling. And I think, you know, that to me, that's the most important thing about Sundance, is that we need to continue to tell these stories and connect people with the stories in ways that, you know, that resonate and that connect with people. So I think that's really positive. And, you know, I haven't done an audit on how they're showing up in our Park City community, but obviously I know there's going to be a lot of, you know, mass transit and hopefully a lot of good practices. I mean, it really is kind of standard operating procedure, I think, for any big event or organization to have an approach to sustainability. So I hope that they're committed to that. But I think the storytelling piece is a good place to start.
Absolutely. And we are so excited because we are going to be talking with Danielle Nirenberg about Food Tank in just a few minutes here. But I also want to hear maybe what you're looking forward to, or things that are coming down the pipeline for the cool down that you're excited for 2025.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm really excited about our guide product that we launched last year. It really gives people, you know, whatever step you want to take, whether it's getting rid of your old stuff or switching to a heat pump or getting solar or whatever it might be, you know, we've built out this really great guide where people are actually sharing photos and asking questions. And so there's a real community that's popping up there. And we really have become kind of a marketplace for the clean economy. So when you do want to make a change like that, you know, a lot of people are coming to us, and we're building out this really amazing partnership, you know, marketplace where people can come and connect with those brands, whether that's, you know, Trashy. We have a big partnership with Trashy because we know that circular economy is so important to people. And that just means like getting rid of your old things responsibly and sometimes getting a reward for that. And so we love Trashy because they give people rewards and discounts, credits when they purchase a Trashy bag and send back their textiles. That way they can get a credit. Same thing with Got Sneakers, where you send your sneakers in and you can get a check back. And we do that with the school here at Jeremy Ranch. So I think, you know, just being able to connect and offer more solutions for people that's really what we are laser focused on this year, is now taking this audience that we have of 30 million people a month and really activating them and helping them to connect with a solution that's going to make an impact both for them and for our planet. So.
Well, Anna, I love having you on the show because you do have this positive approach. And we always talk about sometimes things can get heavy and we can feel heavy about it. And that sometimes leads to inaction because you do feel so heavy. But when you have a place like the Cool Down to go to, and you feel like it's also this organization of people, or this community of people that are coming together in the same way that you are, that are acting on these things, it feels like a very positive way forward.
Well, it's always my pleasure to be here with you and to connect people. It can feel heavy, but we try to do the opposite because, you know, what choice do we have? We have to do the best that we can do to create a better future for our kids and our grandkids and for everybody around us. And, you know, I think we do have an opportunity. There's more that unites us than divides us. And so let's find that common ground and let's try to make as much difference as we can every day. And you know, I really believe, I thought it was going going to be super depressing to get a job in this space. And it's been quite the opposite, because there is so much innovation happening. There are so many good people who really are committed to this, and it doesn't have to be a political issue, and it doesn't have to be hard. So we try to make it really like, how can we help you to make it easier and make it even positive for your own life? So I just challenge everybody to find something that you can do in this space to be part of it. And if you're looking for a place to start, hopefully the Cooldown will be a good resource for you.
And the website.
Thecooldown.com. Sign up for our newsletters. Please feel free to reach out to me, Anna@thecooldown.com, if you want to connect, or if there's anything I can do to help you on your journey as everybody sort of hopefully joins the conversation and the community.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Anna, for joining us again on This Green Earth. We appreciate you. It's thecooldown.com. I suggest everyone go on there and just poke around and take a look, because there are certain topics. I think that, again, we talked about the breadth of topics that you have there. There's going to be something in there that really delights you or instills maybe lights a fire in you. So thanks so much, Anna, for being on our show. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back with Daniel Nuremberg right here on KPCW. Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
We're now going to be speaking with world-renowned researcher, speaker, advocate, and co-founder of Food Tank, Daniel Nuremberg. We want to get to know a little bit more about your path, Daniel, and what led you in this direction. So first, welcome to the show.
Thank you both so much.
And let's get started with a little bit about your background and how you did start going down this path in environment and food science.
Yeah, I grew up in a very small town surrounded by farmers in Defiance, Missouri, and I didn't want anything to do with them. I couldn't wait to go to college and get away from that. From all of that, I was always an environmentalist. I blamed farmers actually for, you know, destroying the rainforest. And after college, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Dominican Republic and worked with so many farmers and extension workers that I realized how much farmers were doing to protect the environment and how much they were doing to, you know, create nutritious foods and have healthy communities. And so after that, I went to the Tufts School of Nutrition Science and Policy and got my MS in agriculture, food, and environment. And started working at a think tank in Washington, D.C. that focused on all things environment, including food. Did a lot of traveling around the world, still do that, but, a lot of on-the-ground reporting at, you know, factory farms in parts of Asia, visiting farmers and all over sub-Saharan Africa, along with policymakers and researchers and other food system stakeholders. And, you know, just trying to find the stories of hope and success, the stories that can inspire people so that they can take action. And that's, you know, why Food Tank exists. We want to amplify the stories that are out there and spread them to a really wide audience.
Yeah, so let's get into some of these food crises that we are facing on the planet first, and what you see as our biggest challenges in the food system to date.
My friend, Dr. Evan Fraser from the University of Guelph, describes it as that we're in the midst of cascading crises. This poly crisis of biodiversity loss, public health challenges, the climate crisis, of course, and they're all, you know, sort of hitting us at the same time. You can see that with the wildfires happening in Los Angeles right now. You can see it all over the world with flooding and droughts and conflict. And, you know, we're facing a lot of these challenges because of, you know, people are hungry because the climate has changed how and when they can grow crops. And, you know, there are political forces that cause folks to be hungry. And so these things we're just seeing them all come together right now. But I do have hope that we can get out of this poly crisis with a lot of what I mentioned before, the folks who are doing the work on the ground, those stories of hope and success.
Danielle, do you see examples of that crisis here in the U.S., in the factory farms and industrial farms here in the U.S.?
Oh, absolutely. We've spread the bad example of factory farming all over the world now. And, you know, you see that there's so many hidden costs of factory farms. Most people don't see the pollution. They're often located in areas that are marginalized where Black and brown folks live. We don't see, you know, the the costs of E. coli and other diseases that come out of them. You know, a lot of, you know, these cheap, the cheap meat that we eat right now has a lot of hidden costs. And if we, you know, actually paid the true cost of those hamburgers and hot dogs and chicken breasts, you know, I think meat would be a lot more expensive. But there's so many great farmers who are, you know, encouraging people to eat less but better meat. They're growing, you know, they call themselves grass farmers because they're growing grass for animals to eat. You have companies like Vital Farms that let their chickens run, you know, run around in the sunshine and in the winter too. And, you know, they, and they're making a profit, especially, you know, right now. So I think there's a different way to do this, but we are seeing the cost of those factory farms, Chris.
Yeah. I like that, growing grass to feed cattle. What a novel idea.
Right.
But also, among many of the environmental impacts, particularly in the Midwest, is the loss of groundwater and the water table receding to points where wells that are hundreds of feet down are running dry. And if they're not running dry, like you alluded to, they're contaminated with either chemicals and the herbicides and pesticides or the heavy metals from the soil. So there's a host of complications and consequences associated with factory farming.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And you know that all of that nitrogen from the manure that's created, it goes into the Gulf of Mexico. It creates dead zones. Where no fish can live. It's, you know, it's a whole host of things that happen because of these factory farms.
Exactly.
And so when you look at these across the board, maybe these farms, and there's a lot of people going into regenerative farming and there's more organic farming, and then you've got these factory farms, is there a middle ground? Is there a place where we can get to, if people can't necessarily go all the way to that regenerative farming, is there a good middle ground, or does it have to be either or?
I never think it has to be either or. I think there's always a space for all kinds of farmers, even the farmers that, you know, I don't particularly agree with their practices. You know, a lot of those big farmers are sort of trapped in a vicious cycle of loans and, you know, subsidies that they can't get out of. I think there is a good medium, right, where you can use some regenerative practices, you know, along with some of those more conventional practices. You know, I think regenerative farming is great for a lot of small and medium sized family farmers and young farmers who want to get into it. But I think conventional farms can also learn from some of those practices and take them on. Again, it doesn't have to be either or. There is a middle ground, Claire. I think there has to be.
Daniel, you mentioned, I think you mentioned that you spent time in the Dominican Republic.
I did. I was a Peace Corps volunteer there.
So what were you observing there amongst the Dominican farmers that really impressed you and perhaps saw as opportunities to American farmers to incorporate into their practices?
They just look, you know, they knew their land so well. They took care of their land so well. Not all farmers in the Dominican Republic were doing that, but some of the farmers I worked with, they just, you know, they had a relationship with the land. And I think that's kind of what we've lost among some of the big farms here in the United States, that relationship with the land, that need to not just be extractive, but to be regenerative. And, you know, a lot of those farmers were growing things like shade-grown coffee and had honeybees and were growing cacao and other things, vegetables sustainably, without herbicides or pesticides or artificial fertilizers. And it worked for them. It doesn't work on every farm, right? You know, farms should have a combination of what works for them the best. But I learned so much from those farmers and extension workers. And that's, you know, I will forever be grateful for that experience.
I do like what you said about understanding the land. And sometimes I think people come in and they don't really have a great understanding of the best way in which to utilize the land or be with the land. It's more like you said, what can we extract from the land? Just looking at is as almost a pillaging of the land. How do we get that mindset back to, we are working with the land, and as we work with the land feeds us, but also we're not tearing apart these ecosystems or poisoning the area.
I mean, that's the question, right? And I think it's by example. You know, there's this one of the films we'll be showing clips of during the festival on Saturday is Common Ground, right? And that shows how farmers all over the country, Republican and Democrat farmers, are taking on these regenerative techniques and really listening to the land and making a bigger profit than they were when they were, you know, growing conventionally. And I think that's the sort of secret sauce right there, that you can do this and still make money and make, you know, make enough money to send your kids to college, you know, not to have to have an off-farm job, that you can do this in a way that is good for your, you know, your economic sustainability and the sustainability of the land.
So Danielle, let's talk about the films that are going to be showing at Sundance and other activities or events that's going to be happening with.
We're so excited, Chris, about the conversations we'll be having all day. Like I said, we'll have a clip of Common Ground, and producer and director Josh Tickell will be there. We're going to have films from. A really great, the inspiration for this film was a really great book written by Leah Penniman of Soulfire Farm. The film is called Farming While Black, and it shows, you know, how Black and brown farmers across the country are going, you know, taking on farming, doing it in a regenerative way, teaching others. The producer of it, Lynn Weir, was telling me, she's like, we started off as having, you know, this idea of this film as a film for Black and brown farmers. And what we discovered at the end is that it's a story for all of us, that we can all be inspired by it. And that just really strikes me as something kind of beautiful. They started off with one vision and now, you know, they have a completely different one. We'll have my friend Stephen Ritz is an educator and urban farmer, and he works with school kids in the Bronx, and he has a film coming out called Generation Growth, and it's showing how kids are you know, learning to grow their own food, learning to cook, you know, learning you know, how to eat better, and it's just so inspiring. He's quite a character, and is always a good time on stage. I'm going to be talking to my friend Brandon Lombardi, who is the Chief Sustainability Officer at Sprouts Market. And he's going to be talking about some of the things that the Sprouts Market Foundation does to encourage healthier eating among children. They sponsor a lot of school gardens. They work with a lot of different organizations. And it's really inspiring. There's also a couple of clips from a film called From the Heartland. And that's about farmers who are, you know, sort of going from conventional to more regenerative practices. And then there's this great film called Cafe Iaves, and it's about how coffee and bird biodiversity can go hand in hand. So coffee growing and you know, biodiversity can go hand in hand. So you know, these are just some snapshots of the films, but we also are going to have really great discussions on storytelling, because we think, you know, Sundance is really all about storytelling, right? You know, it's films that are meant to inspire and motivate. And so we'll have panels about how people tell stories in different ways. Julia Collins is the head of a company called Planet Forward, and she helps other companies reduce their carbon footprint through data and measurement and finding out, you know, what they can do to reduce their impact on the climate crisis. Lakeisha May is a Broadway actress and environmental and a food storyteller. And so she'll be on stage talking about how you can use culture and the arts to you know, really speak to people and help them change, you know, change their minds. I think, you know, changing your mind about some of these things, people come in with, you know, preconceived notions about what it means to be a regenerative farmer. And they might, you know, be like, oh, that'll never work. But, you know, telling these stories in all kinds of different ways, I think, is really important.
We are speaking with world-renowned researcher, speaker, advocate, and co-founder of Food Tank, Danielle Nirenberg. And Danielle, you've been talking about this fourth annual All-Day Food and Environment Summit brought to us by Food Tank during Sundance. Can we get to how Food Tank began, how you founded that, and what your main goals are?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. The year before the pandemic, we decided, hey, let's go to Sundance. We were working with Chef Alice Waters and some other folks to really sort of just highlight, food and culture at that time. And we were a very small part of it. And then, we decided post-pandemic and that we would do it again. And we've taken it on without the partners we had before. We love them. We still do, but it's great to really have this have these conversations and bring a lot of chefs together. Blue Adams, Chef Blue Adams is the head of Indigia Hub, but she's also a restaurateur from Utah. She'll be there. Dave White, who is a chef on Bravo's Below Deck, will be there. He's a famous chef. Kamado Joe's Eric Gephardt will be cooking and grilling outside. So we just have we want to do this because there are so many people in town. You all know this, right? There's so many people in town who, don't know about these issues, but are curious. And often, and I'm not blaming the Sundance Festival for this at all, often food and environment and agriculture films are not chosen, right? And a lot of them are being made. And so if we can show clips of these films and expose the people who are already at the festival, I think it's just a great way to get them involved and, to know a little bit more about where their food comes from and to know about the people who are growing it.
It sounds like there's enough to have your own food film festival.
We'd love that, believe me.
Maybe someday down the road, huh?
Talk a little bit about food deserts, because here in Park City, we
Yeah.
are blessed, and I don't think we, enough of us, appreciate how many full service supermarkets we have. I think the last count, it was five, and I think there was another supermarket looking to get into the Park City, Summit County area. We have so much food here in Park City, but talk about and maybe Food Tank does discuss the ideas of food deserts and the complications associated with those things and how to overcome that.
Absolutely. And that topic of food deserts, we refer to it as food apartheid, but that issue will be addressed in Generation Growth, the film that Stephen Ritz will be talking about. Food deserts are places where there are very few grocery stores. They're often in marginalized urban areas. I live in Baltimore. There are many food deserts across the city, unfortunately, and also pharmacy deserts. It's a political problem, right? Politicians and business people don't feel like these areas that they'll make a lot of money, and so they leave people sort of without the ability to buy food, or they have to take three buses to buy food, or they have to go to the liquor store and eat some buy ultra processed foods that aren't really good for them, and that's what they can afford, and that's what they can get to. And so really, there needs to be better policies in, at the federal level, but also at the state and local level to make sure that, food is available to everyone, whether it's through mobile food markets, mobile farmers markets, building, smaller but nice grocery stores in areas with culturally relevant food that's available to the people who live there. But there's a lot of work that needs to be done on this issue.
Are you finding, though, that a lot of solutions are arising? Are we focusing on these solutions? And we try to always put a hopeful spin on some of these greater challenges that we're facing. And do you think there is an understanding that there needs to be more reformation?
I am always hopeful. That's part of my job, right? And with the last with the Biden-Harris administration, there was a national strategy on hunger, nutrition, and health. And part of that was increasing access and affordability. And what the White House was able to do was to gain commitments from a lot of corporates, including some of the ones I mentioned, Sprouts, Whole Foods, and others, to make sure that there are grocery stores in areas where they are needed, and to make food more accessible to folks in lots of different ways. So hopefully those commitments will continue no matter who is in office. I do have hope. And a lot is happening from food policy consults, across the country who see these problems in their own towns and cities and are coming up with solutions. And I think that's, you know, that kind of ground up, you know, groundswell of you know, seeing a problem and then fixing it is really exciting.
You mentioned it, Danielle. You know, we had, starting like right now, we have a new administration in place. Any sense of perhaps any reading the tea leaves of this new administration, what changes that might occur, good or bad?
Yeah, it's an interesting question for sure. I talked to a former Joel Salatin the other day on my podcast, and he calls himself a sort of a libertarian farmer, and he's had a lot of discussions, you know, with RFK Jr., Robert F. Kennedy Jr., about these things. And so I think there is some hope that things will continue in a way where we can have a healthy America. I don't want to really use the motto that they're using, but I think there are opportunities here. But there were opportunities during the last administration too. So I don't want those to be forgotten, but I hope we keep going forward. And this is where I really think at the local and you know, city, state level, there are enlightened mayors and, you know, commissioners who are doing the hard work to make, you know, food more affordable and more accessible and you know, available to communities who have been, you know, historically marginalized because of inherent racism. So I do think that there's this chance that we have right now to really invest in that local and regional, those local and regional politicians and policymakers, and really push them to get these things done. Because when things don't happen at the federal level, it's up to us, you know, in our towns and in our cities to make change happen.
Well, as an aside, I think what we don't need or could certainly do less of is, as an example, a cereal aisle that contains 55 different types of cereals, you know, 52 of them ultra processed or, you know, sugar laden and just unhealthy for us. And actually, you know, I have a lot of issues with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. too, but, you know, perhaps he at least seems to have understand the impacts and consequences to our health and welfare from ultra processed foods like that, you know, that come out of that cereal aisle. So
yeah, no, I feel the same way as you do, and I am hopeful that change can be made if he's you know, certified as the head of health and human services. You know, the last health and human services secretary, Admiral Levine, she was focused on these issues too. And I don't want that to be forgotten. It's not just RFK who's brought this up. You know, this has been an issue that health and human services has been working on for a while now.
Danielle, what's the schedule for all of these films and events?
We start at 10:30 on Saturday, and we go all day until 5. We are completely sold out. We, you know, it's free to attend, right? And we have a huge waiting list of about 2,000 people, I think. So we hope it's really successful. We hope we can get more people in as people sort of trickle in and out during the day. But it's going to be so much fun, and I'm so grateful to be back in Park City. I love Utah. Y'all have, you know, are so great, and, you know, do so many good things. So thank you for the opportunity to talk to you all.
Well, thank you so much, Danielle, for coming on the show. Nice. It's Danielle Nirenberg, who is a world-renowned researcher, speaker, advocate, and co-founder of Food Tank, and they will be here at Sundance this coming Saturday to host a 4th annual all-day food and environment summit. Thank you so much for joining us on This Green Earth.
Thank you.
Thanks, Danielle.